Welcome, everyone, to On Background. I'm your host, Fred DeLore, here in the iPolitics studio, and I'm thrilled you're joining us for another episode. If you're new here, make sure to explore our extensive library of episodes that have been capturing engaging discussions over the past few months. Our journey has taken us through a variety of captivating topics, from the intense showdown between Trudeau and Poilievre to debates over Justin Trudeau's leadership future. We've delved into the evolution of polling techniques that are reshaping our understanding of election outcomes, examined the dynamics between war rooms and press rooms, and pondered whether Poilievre needs a majority to govern, a question that seems increasingly relevant. Our exploration didn't stop there. We've analyzed the impact of social media strategies of both Trudeau and Poilievre, brought in experts from their respective parties, and provided insights into the life of a political staffer in Ottawa. Our episodes have covered Quebec politics, caucus discipline, electoral reform, and the beauty of parliamentary procedure. Along the way, we've been joined by distinguished guests, experts in their fields, Tories, grits, dippers, media hacks, pollsters, all who have enriched our discussions with their deep knowledge and true understanding of the game. And all of this has been shared over a few beers as we sit back and engage in what I truly believe are meaningful conversations here on Background. In today's episode, we're marking a significant moment, the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I want to talk about the politics of this and other world events and how Canadians feel about it all. So coming onto the show today is Dan Lauzon, the former Director of Communications for the Liberal Party of Canada, someone I sparred with a lot back in the day when I was DCOM for the Tories. He later worked throughout the Liberal government, most recently in foreign affairs, and now is with CAE as Senior Director, Public Affairs and Policy for International. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Fred. Real pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot.
Just a quick aside, I was thinking back to our time when we were dueling DCOMs. Mm-hmm. I don't think a week went by for many years that you and I weren't quoted in stories together, punching or counter-punching punching each other. So it's great to have you on today. And not that it's an easy topic, but I don't expect any punches will be thrown between us. At least I hope not.
No, not at all. No, that's always been quite fun. And it actually, I was looking at some of the articles yesterday. And it sort of brings me back to the joys of opposition, right? Where you can just kind of go and trade barbs. And I have to say, it was hilarious for me to find that we were on, we were both listed as two of the top 25 Hill Times staffers in 2012.
Oh, there you go!
That was excellent.
Wow. I probably didn't give you a congratulations then.
On the way back machine.
So right, it was good awesome. Stuff. Well, look, given you work in this in defense and security, can you give us a primer of sorts? Where are we in the world right now with all the hot spots and all of the conflicts that are happening?
Yeah. Well, one of the things when I left foreign affairs was I've always been interested in international affairs. I've always been interested in what's happening in the world and Canada's position in it. And I've been spending a lot of time studying that, reading that. And as a student of it, I have to say that we're in an interesting spot. And I think that the war in Ukraine brought into focus a lot of those issues. So let's just take a look at what's changed,
right?
You know, since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine just 2 years ago. You have a country like Germany that has completely changed its defense posture. You have a country like Japan that's completely changed its defense posture. You have other countries looking at what does the world look like? What does this multipolar polycrisis world look like? And that's fundamental, because the reason I use the example of Germany and Japan, those defense postures and that rules-based order that brought some semblance of structure to world affairs throughout the post-World War II period, that entire structure, that rules-based order is falling apart and no longer holds. And countries like Germany and Japan are looking at how do we position ourselves with that. Countries in the Middle East are looking at how do we position ourselves. And of course, the Iran, Russia, China group are looking at what this means for them and influence around the world. So much has changed and so much has been brought to the fore. But I think what's often lost in the back and forth of will the U.S. supply weapons to Ukraine? Will Europe need to stand on its own 2 feet? Are we contributing to NATO, et cetera? Is the fundamental shift in the geopolitical world order and alliances around the world.
And what's your thoughts on that? Like, it seems the liberal government's been pretty engaged on this.
Yeah. Look, I think it comes in a couple different ways, right? So yes, the Liberal government, Trudeau, Minister Jolie have been extremely active on this, as have successive ministers of defense. And I would say that this all comes back to the Michaels and the fact that shortly after the Liberal government came on, we got some very significant signals that the assumptions that once underpinned our view of the world were no longer holding. That has been true for several years. What the war in Ukraine has done is really sort of put that to the fore and showed, look, we have a ground war in Europe. None of us thought we'd see that in our lifetime.
Right.
Canada has to come to terms with the fact that a position at the G7, a position at the G20, our NATO alliances, our NORAD alliance, all of that is kind of quaint. And unless Canada is able to articulate its own interests, unless Canada is able to move to the fore and say, this is what we will contribute to global security, none of those formalities really mean what they used to, because they were based on a world order that served our interest. And I think it's time for us as Canadians to look at it and say, actually, the world order that is shaping and that reshaping no longer automatically serves Canada's interests. And that's a really difficult shift. So I actually don't blame the political leaders for this, because for whatever reason, no groundswell of public opinion marching on the street, real hard social political discussion in coffee shops around Ottawa or Arnprior or Surrey, BC, on how are we going to position ourselves in this new world.
Right.
And there's no pressure for our leaders to take a stand on that. And I cannot understand why that's not the case.
Well, it's interesting. When Ukraine was invaded by Russia 2 years ago, I remember watching it. We were glued to the TV. My wife and I do not watch the evening news,
right?
Like most Canadians. But during this period, every night it was like must-see TV, like to find out what's going on.
Yeah.
And we were getting live images, and it was for weeks on end. We were following this closely, and then it waned off. The coverage waned off, right? Like we had CBC and CTV were based out of Poland, I believe, and like parts of Ukraine, and covering it. They had all of their anchors there and doing their stories there. So it was really hot then for us. And then it dropped off after time. Mm-hmm. And then after October 7th and what happened in the Middle East, it really dropped off in terms of following it.
Yeah.
So it's like we're not seeing the stuff. It's still with social media and stuff. You still hear about it and things are still pushed. But it's not at all the same level. Like I remember at Christmas actually talking to a friend of mine who is a very prominent Ukrainian Canadian. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I haven't seen any updates on what's happening for months there.
Yeah.
It's like we lose focus so easily on these things. Why do you think that, I guess it's pretty explanatory why that is. There's just so many other things going on in our lives. So do you think Canadians care enough about this though?
No, I don't think we do. I really don't. I don't think we spend enough time thinking about it, and I don't think we spend enough time talking about it.
Right.
In a way, because we have... So in a way, we look at everything going on in the world and we think, well, that won't affect us because of our geography. That won't affect us because of our alliances. It won't affect us because of our economy. And so we have the luxury of being able to look at our bills day to day and domestic issues that are real, and people are struggling with those issues, and they believe that there is that their broader safety and security is being handled or being shepherded through by a series of systems and institutions that serve our interests. But they're not.
Right.
No one is looking at Canada's interests other than Canadians. No one is out there seeking our best interest. No one is looking to advance Canada's position in the world other than Canadians. And if we're not having those open discussions, if we're not having those frank discussions, we're going to get left behind.
Right. So we won't be a part of any decision making in the future too on this stuff too, right? In terms of how we defend.
No, I don't think so. I think Canadians have allowed ourselves to be fat, drunk, and happy.
Right.
And it's a strange thing, right? I think that we need to talk, and the reason I want to talk about it so badly is because if you think of Maslow's, you know, pyramid of needs, and I think this is something actually, Fred, that the Tories do exceptionally well. It's let's go right to the base of what people need to feel, like from a political communication standpoint, what do people need to feel safe? For whatever reason, this fundamental geopolitical realignment around the world is either too diffuse, too complicated, too abstract for Canadians to truly be afraid. And therefore, their attention is elsewhere, and nor are they demanding action on these things. All these distractions and every conflict, every sanction, every distraction around the world is an opportunity for new alliances to build, for new alliances to come forward, for countries who truly understand and have articulated and are able to articulate their interests to make a chess move. If we are not looking at the board the way everyone else is, then we're not fully capturing the gravity of this moment, and we're not positioning ourselves to be winners in the game that is taking shape. And part of it is sleight of hand, right? There are actors in the world that are exceptionally good at this, and they take advantage of those crises, and they take advantage of the fact that we are very quick to chase squirrels as a population.
What do you mean by that?
So, you know, my son's 12 years old, and he's just started to pay attention to world affairs. And he said, you know, after the October 7th, the absolute atrocities of the Hamas attacks and the humanitarian crisis that's ensued, he had, you know, there was some talk of Venezuela and Guyana.
Right.
He's looking at the news. You know, a few years ago, there were the truckers. And he says to me, well, first it was the truckers, and then it was the war in Ukraine, and now it's the Middle East. There's always something. Like, he's 12 years old, and he's come to that realization that there's always something going on in the world. And the way that our media environment is today, it's so easy for us to get distracted and move on. And to not see that every time something like that happens, if we don't take a firm position, we're falling behind.
Right. And there's always something elsewhere in the world where Canada's had so much stability. And with our alliances, you mentioned the alliances, like we've been, you know, pretty rock solid in those for decades and decades and decades. Generations have gone through this. It's all they know. And to your point about our geography, like we're right next door to Big Brother, the biggest U.S. or the biggest military in the world. And we only share a land border with two countries. U.S. and we share Hans Island with Denmark.
That's
so
right.
We're not, you know, we're not vulnerable in that sense. So how do we make Canadians care? Is there a way to get them engaged on this, to understand that Canada does have a role to play? And we have in the past, right? Like Pearson won a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
You had Stephen Harper famously tell Putin to get out of Ukraine, which I thought was amazing leadership from him. And you have, you know, the current government is doing its part in some ways, like they're sending stuff over there. But how do we get Canadians fired up that this is a big deal and that we should be taking this more seriously?
Yeah, I think if we can't seize on the moment that there is a ground war in Europe and that NATO is gaining strength, gaining members, and that the international community is mobilized over a very real and precise threat, then I don't think there's much hope for us. And I will give the government, and in fact all parliamentarians, full credit for standing up for and with Ukraine, and for the solidarity that's been shown. And I know there's been a lot of games and barbs and back and forth. People won't agree with me on this, but I think by and large, Canada has been a friend to Ukraine. Canada has been a steadfast ally and will continue to be. If that doesn't wake people up, though, then I think we've got bigger problems of you know, civics classes in school and things like that.
Right.
But I have there is a path for me that I think could at least get that is a shorthand for Canadians to understand, and one that might be able to mobilize civil society, because it's something that Canadians have done before. And that's looking at our continental security and taking that exceptionally seriously. So I understand that Ukraine is a long way away for a lot of people. I mean, some people have deep family ties and friends in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I think that that's helped us feel closer to that conflict, but it's still thousands of miles away. We are in the process of NORAD modernization. We are in a process of some soul searching at NATO. And I think, you know, you mentioned Big Brother earlier. The fact that the United States is so close and that our economic, social, and defense interests are so closely linked with the United States, I think if we were to focus our attention on defining that relationship and showing the United States, the American people, regardless of which administration comes in, I think that people will find that the tolerance for an ally that's not serious about security and securing its own borders and securing its continent will be quite low, regardless of who wins in November.
Right.
And my point is, if we were to just narrow, right? I mentioned something earlier about let's define our interests. So let's get smart about it. So do we agree that close economic collaboration and integration with the United States is important to Canada? I think most of us do.
Yeah.
Right? Across party lines, across regional differences, we agree on that. And we've mobilized in the past to make that happen. So I'd say, let's take a look at what we can do in our own backyard. Let's start having the conversation about what it would take to show Joe Biden and Donald Trump that Canada is serious about continental security.
Well, that's interesting. Like, Trump has mentioned recently how he expects every NATO partner to pay their fair share. And if they don't, then what did he say? He's going to pull out of NATO, or he's just going to kick them out? I can't recall.
He went further than that, Fred. He said, if you don't pay, not only will we not protect you, I will encourage Russia to attack you.
Right.
Which?
Pleasant. that's a very different statement than what I said. Eh? Much more.
Over the top.
And right? He could win this presidency.
Yeah,
he could. And if Canada doesn't meet its 2%, and can we ever meet our 2%? What is your thoughts there? Because we're so far away from it. And we've still been spending a lot, right? Like, we've still increased a lot, but how do we...
I actually think the 2% GDP NATO or defense spending contribution is a red herring. I think that's a distraction to the conversation that we need to be having. The reason I say that is that it would require so much, such a realignment that from a fiscal framework perspective, such an investment in fiscal firepower that I'm not sure Canada's in position to do that short term. Then we can, I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I think that what's lacking in that conversation is what can Canada contribute, right? It's
right.
one thing to just spend billions.
Right.
Okay. It's one thing to spend billions on defense, whatever that means. But let's think about, if we were to spend that, what would we spend it on, and what is Canada's contribution to global security? Is it defending the Arctic? Is it staking a claim and saying that we as a country and as a NATO ally will defend the Arctic?
Right.
Is it training? Right. So one of the industrial, and I'll make a quick plug for CAE here, but one of our industrial strengths in Canada is flight training. We train most commercial pilots in the world, and we train military pilots all over the world. Is that the contribution that Canada should be making around the world? That's one option. Is it ammunition? Is it drones? Is it Zodiacs, right? There's so much that Canada could be doing, but I find that our contributions are diffuse. And so before we have the conversation about how much we're spending, let's have the conversation about what we can realistically do.
Right.
Because you mentioned the Suez Canal earlier, right? So Pearson won a Nobel Prize for his role in that, for Canada's role in that. And recently, when with the crisis in the Red Sea and that same canal being in jeopardy, Canada and other allies joined a statement, but did not contribute military resources to securing that part of the world. But I also think that it's not Canada's destiny to be everything to everyone, right? We can't act as though we are the United States because we are not. But what can we do? And I would love to hear that conversation more openly about what is it that we could contribute. And right. I think continental security, it's such a big continent. It's such an important part of the world. It's so important to our biggest ally. It's critical to our personal safety, our economic safety, all of our interests. Why don't we focus on our own backyard, show the world and show our closest ally that we're taking it seriously? And that's, yes, it's financial, but it's also just pulling together civil society. It's pulling together the private sector, you know, military think tanks, all the groups that you can think to pull together the way we have, for example, after 2016. And let's make a full court press and say, not only are we committed to economic security, we are committed to continental security. And I think that would go a long way to saying, okay, maybe we're not going to be the saviors of all of Europe, but maybe we can do our part. And our part is we're going to make sure that our border is safe, our continent is safe, and we're going to be as close a friend and an ally to the United States as we can be from a defense perspective.
That's interesting. With the there does seem to be a growing, particularly in the conservative movement, isolationist approach, mm-hmm. where we're not as keen to be sending resources across the ocean. And when I say growing within the conservative movement, it's small, but it's there. And it's throughout Canada too, not just within this party. Mm. So what you're saying could work in that regard, right? If we're putting the resources here to build up and play our part. But one thing about this is the politics of it all. Mm-hmm. Do voters ever care about defense spending or foreign wars or conflicts? Because I can't think of a time in my time in politics where they have. I remember famously in 2021, Afghanistan was falling, and you guys called an election. And for the first week or so of that election, that really dominated the headlines. And I was pleased with our campaign that we were disciplined not to start talking about it too aggressively, because our research showed voters, they were interested in it. They weren't happy that Afghanistan was falling, but they weren't going to move their votes on it. So it was, you know, we had our campaign plan and narrative that we're pushing on Canada's recovery plan. Yeah. And there was I was getting a lot of pressure to just talk about Afghanistan, but I knew the votes weren't there. Even though we're seeing this live happening right now, the votes weren't there.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, the interesting thing on something like Afghanistan is I think that there is a realism when it comes to Canadians' view of what's happening in the world. And that's the reason that one didn't stick to the government in the way that it perhaps could have. And the reason that your numbers weren't showing that it was an effective attack is because I don't think anybody credibly believed that Canada was responsible for the shit show that was the withdrawal in Afghanistan, and that Canada was a part and had been an incredibly important part and had contributed significantly to that country. But in that moment, other bigger players were calling the shots, and politically, militarily, diplomatically, Canada was not responsible for that. I think that's unfortunate, because I think in a way that's a little bit of an abdication, not on the part of, again, the government, but on the part of Canadians to say, well, what are you going to do?
Right.
And I think that's what it was. It was a bit of a shrug of, boy, the world really is going to hell in a handbasket. I don't like what's happening out there. But is there anything we can realistically do about it? And then you move on. And it's a little bit like, in some ways, the challenge is so big and we feel so small that we don't engage. And I think that's a mistake. Because if we spent more time thinking about what does this mean for us? Where does this leave us? Then perhaps we could find little nuggets of hope, but also little nuggets of where we can be effective,
right?
In the stakes that are there. And you know, we talk about this as though it's high-minded and we want to contribute to global security. I'm guilty of saying that just now. What about us? Like, what about my family's future? What about your family's future? What about our security? Like, what if new borders open up?
Right.
What if somebody comes over the top? Are we ready? And I think that the thought of that and the answer to that question is so overwhelming that people would rather focus on things they understand and have some semblance of control on, like their mortgage and their cell phone bill,
mm-hmm.
That they can say, well, maybe this is something we can tackle, but the other stuff is just too big and too scary, and we're too small as a country. And frankly, I think it's an abdication culturally of our role in the world, but it's also really sad because we have been given in the last 80 years every opportunity to be a major player.
Right.
We sit at all the best tables. We're part of all the best trade deals. We have the United States as our savior and guardian right next door. We are respected around the world. We have a very strong brand. We have bilingualism and multiculturalism and ways that we can really reach out to the world and contribute. And for whatever reason, it's very Canadian of us, we sort of take a step back and think, well, we're not that influential, or perhaps we shouldn't be playing in that space, or maybe we'll defer to someone else.
And why is that? Do you think it's our proximity to the U.S., though, too, that where we just look like a puppet on the world stage? Do people think we stand on our own, or is the perception that we don't?
Mm.
And is that built into other countries' minds? Because, you know, every time it feels like we're tied right into them, and we're a pawn of the U.S.
I think, unfortunately, that's the perception we have and over several decades have played into.
So it's our own doing, perhaps.
I think so.
Interesting.
Yeah. Everybody knows we're at the G7 because the U.S. wanted us there.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we're not at the table.
Right.
That doesn't make it any less legitimate.
And deserving now, right? Our population is growing and we do have an abundance of resources that we are exporting.
But it's based on the fact that we assume that all these institutions, these tables, these discussions, these fora are designed to serve our interest because they used to be. And for my entire lifetime, your entire lifetime, they were, and they did serve our interests. So that's why I come back to the fat, drunken, happy part, that we're just so pleased and chuffed that we're at all these, we're getting all the right invites and we're at all the right tables and we're doing the right thing around the world. But for whatever reason, we hesitate to really, truly do something to really, truly do it as though we're there as a courtesy And so let's not rock the boat.
What's your sense on Prime Minister Pierre Poilievre and what his approach is going to be? I'm curious to get a liberal perspective on this, because as a conservative, I have no idea what his foreign policy is going to be. I can tell you pretty well every domestic policy where I think he'll be aligned with. Yeah. But when it comes to, I know he's come out, I believe, in the last week or so about how we'll meet our 2% commitment to NATO. I don't know how he's going to do that. I don't believe he'll be able to do that. But I'm curious if you have a sense of what his foreign policy will, and defense policy will be.
Well, if you or the Conservatives are looking for a policy solution, the way to get to 2% is bringing the GST back to 7%.
Wow. So that's not happening. So
exactly. Right. So I think that any politician in this country or anywhere else is right to be thinking about what best serves their country's interest. And I'm actually okay with a little bit of protectionist rhetoric. I think it's incumbent upon all our leaders and elected leaders to think about Canada first.
Right. It is defense, not offense, right?
In order to do that, you need to be serious about continental security. You need to be serious about our own backyard, and you need to rebuild and to not, I won't say rebuild. Actually, I'd like to take that back. We need to demonstrate and continue to demonstrate that we're not abdicating on world affairs, but that we want to play a role. And then define that role in a very humble Canadian way, that this is what we're going to do.
Right.
This is our role, right? And I think that that's an opportunity for any elected leader to go and to say, what are we going to focus on? And so what I see with the current government, what I would hope that Parliament can do is put aside any kind of partisan interest and look at, or even regional, right? Because it's really hard to define interests in such a broad federalist system. But in the sense of just say, what's the low-hanging fruit and where can we go? I think a lot of people think that suddenly Canada's defense posture is going to change whenever a conservative movement builds, takes on strength. And I think that's just not true. I think the Liberals have doubled defense spending. They have not, though, been politically rewarded for doubling defense spending.
They've actually doubled since the Harper government. They've doubled defense spending.
Yeah.
Amazing.
If you look, I think it's by 2026, Canada will have doubled its defense spending.
Wow.
And nobody talks about that. Nobody knows that. Nobody brags about that.
Well, and to your point about being rewarded for it, and I think it comes down to people don't care, and that goes to the whole basic theme of what we're talking about, is people just don't care.
Well, look, I'll give you another real good example, and I think this is why it's not going to change under governments of any stripe, because this government does take defense and security seriously. Trudeau takes safety and security seriously. What he's not getting is true, genuine grassroots push to do more.
Right.
And so governing is about choosing.
And there is no grassroots for any party, right? I don't see it in the conservative movement either. There is no push to, there's some segments, but it's not a...
No. And that's why that push won't be there for anyone else either. Mm-hmm. And, you know, General Eric Kenney, the commander of our Air Force, sat at the Shaw Center last November in front of the Aerospace Industries Association of Canada, and said, our Air Force is not ready, and we will be operationally irrelevant until X date. And then Minister Blair came on afterwards and agreed with him that, we're not in a good spot. And I'll pull out those quotes from General Kenney, because it was quite stark. It was, if we were to face an attack right now, we're not ready. So the commander of the Air Force is out there saying this publicly. So where's the convoy, right? Where's the upswell? Where's the push from Canadians to tell our leaders that this is an absolutely unacceptable situation that we find ourselves in.
Right. Well, I think it there goes were to, no, yeah, we're not ready, but there's no threat that people
sure
see.
Sure there
right?
is.
No, but people don't see the threat is what I'm saying. There is no, we have, when's the last time our country was invaded? War of 1812? it's been a while. So I, and we weren't even an actual country then. So I can see the mentality is just people don't feel the threat. It's not in front of us.
And I think that's what it's coming down to. And that's what this conversation is. That's why it's so important that we need to demonstrate that what we believe to be the status quo, the relative comfort that we've enjoyed for our entire lifetimes and our parents' lifetimes, is no longer. And right. and there are threats. There are economic threats. There are threats to our way of life, our values, and our personal safety and security.
Right.
And I'm going to go home tonight and I'm going to sleep just fine. Because it's not, perhaps it's not as imminent as it is elsewhere in the world, but it is real. And boy, do we need to start taking it seriously.
It's interesting to talk about what Canadians can do on this front. And I understand we put a lot of resources into research, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that counts in the 2% NATO commitment, some of that. Because there's something
weird,
there.
It's weird accounting.
Right, because the 2% is like there's some formula that NATO has in their head office that countries have to abide by, but it doesn't mean there's other ways to look at it that could apply. What I'm getting at is that there could be ways to reach that 2% by doing different things. And the wars, combat evolves so quickly during combat. We're seeing it in Ukraine and Russia, where it felt like, you know, Russia invaded, they came in, they didn't actually seem that prepared. The Ukrainians were defending themselves, and then a lot of the other countries that were there to support didn't feel quite ready either, from my non-expert opinion. But it seems to have evolved, and like drones have really taken on a big part of this war now, which has changed the game significantly in the way it works. And it's like you needed that combat, that thing to realize you got to fix these things or change how you fight. So it'll be interesting if that's a role Canada could play, where we put a lot of our, because we have such a great brain trust here in terms of science and research,
AI, cyber. I think that there's a tremendous opportunity for Canada to contribute in the non-lethal space.
So what would that be? What is?
It's what we just, it's part of what we mentioned, right? Training is a huge part of what we do abroad and always have done, whether it's, you know, through the RCMP, through our men and women in the Canadian Forces. We have a very proud history of that. But, you know, you just mentioned the cyber, the AI, advancing warfare, the command and control. C2ISR, those kinds of things that we can look at and think we can bring some serious brain power here. We don't just need to be exporting weapons in the traditional sense.
Right.
We could be looking at how do we want to make warfare, it sounds so naive for me to say make warfare more humane, but just there are huge pieces of the supply chain, of the command and control structure, of that we could be contributing to and looking at and advancing, that would be a deterrent, that would demonstrate a level of sophistication beyond certainly a World War II style ground war in Europe, and ways of advancing warfare and preparedness that doesn't involve killing people, because I honestly don't think that's who we are.
Right.
And it's something I face in the defense industry all the time, right? People are like, hey, I mean, you should have seen the signs and the protesters outside the Halifax Security Forum. They don't think highly of me or my industry. But at the same time, I think there's a need to look at what safety and security means, focus on the fact that it is safety and security, that is about protecting our interests, and that there are things you can do to contribute to that global order, and you can contribute to, you know, people's sense of safety and security around the world, without being involved in some of the nastier, pointier ends of that enterprise. And we could be a leader in that space.
Right.
I think it's a very Canadian thing to do. Right.
It sounds very interesting. Where I'm just thinking to try to look at everything through the political lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
I could see it being a vote getter in the sense that those who care about these issues care about we have to. People understand we have to invest in our defense, in our military.
Yeah.
Again, not something that when they go to the ballot box, it's top of mind. But to have a government that they know is focused on something that works, and that works within the global world,
yeah.
And it sounds like what you're saying, that could be it if we mm-hmm. took that focus to really put it into securing our own borders.
You know, you and I mentioned a presentation that I was in the room for from our friend David Coletto. There's two things that came out of that. One was he said 86% of Canadians feel the world is on the wrong track.
Right. That's amazing. 86%.
Yet nowhere in, you know, you and I are used to looking at polling and things like that, but things that motivate people, things that people bring up spontaneously, things that make their top priorities, it is not there. And we had a brief conversation and an exchange where he said, but I think there is room for leadership in that space.
Right. If you phrase it like that and show, it's not about where you're spending the money, but that you're showing leadership on this, particularly on the world stage, there could be a path there to get votes.
But I think there's an opportunity for our leaders to be clear-eyed about what threats we're facing, to be honest with us about what those are, to be honest about what our limitations are, and to lead a movement where Canadians take their place in the world and are prepared to define it, as opposed to, you know, as I mentioned earlier, deferring to perhaps other actors looking at the things with a bit of a helpless sense of dread or misplaced optimism, one of the two.
Right.
Well, we could say, this is what we're going to do as a country. Here's where we see it. But that's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. I think it's important. And I think it's something that we should be doing more. I want to thank you for the opportunity to even be talking about this, because I think it's going to take conversations, real talk, and an audience for people to realize that maybe things aren't the way they used to be. Maybe we're not as privileged as we used to be. And we better clue into that before it's too late, because it's not too late.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the West's response initially was about sanctions, was about taking on the economic system, about removing them from the SWIFT systems, etc. And it was really demonstrably to cripple Russia. And guess what? That didn't happen either.
Right.
And Russia started fighting back with all kinds of different tactics.
Well, sanctions themselves, right? They've they did counter sanctions. I was actually sanctioned by Russia. I'm banned from Russia.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It's a badge of honor. It was I woke up one morning to a text from my friend Larissa Whaler, who is a outspoken Ukrainian Canadian and real champion of the cause. Mm-hmm. Sent me a text saying you made the list with a link, and I looked at the link and it looked like it was a Russian link. So I'm not. Is this spam? I'm not looking at this. I'm not checking this at all. And then about an hour later, Jeff Ballingall. From Canada Proud fame, send me a text saying, hey, we're both been banned from Russia. And I was like, okay, so this, I went back to Larissa's text and realized it was legitimate and clicked on it. And there it was. There was three of us, me, Jeff, and Jenny Byrne, were sanctioned randomly one summer day in 2021. Or 2022, sorry. Badge of honor. Now, they did spell my name wrong for some reason. They two R's in Delory, but nonetheless, it's something to be proud of to be banned from Russia. I did have to cancel our trip to Siberia that we were planning, but
the Trans-Siberian Express was that the tour that you had.
Well, look, this was a this was a lot of fun. It was an important conversation to have to mark the 2-year anniversary, and it is something that I you know, for this show and in my life, I try to look at everything through a political lens and what moves votes. And I think we both agree this is very hard to move votes in this issue, but at the same time, incredibly important to find paths for leadership to be able to come out and talk about these issues.
Yeah, I think there's very little political upside to taking a stand on some of those issues and to devoting a lot of time. But at the same time, it's why people elected the people in charge. It's to take care of the things that are so big that we can only deal with it collectively. And
we like strong leaders too, right? If they can show strength.
Absolutely.
In their commitment to these things.
Strength and clarity.
Yeah.
Clarity of purpose. Let's define our interests, articulate them, and act on them. That's all it takes.
Right. Well, look, thanks so much. This was fun.
Thanks, Fred. All right. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, thanks so much for listening in to another episode of On Background. This was a really interesting chat, a bit of depth and policy that I don't tend to always go into, but I think it's important, particularly this time of year with this anniversary. Please don't forget to like and subscribe and check out our growing library of episodes. A lot of the episodes are timeless in many regards, and I think there's a lot of stuff in there if you haven't listened to them already. And until next week, I'm Fred DeLory, and we'll see you then.